Democrat of the day today is actually one of my favorite senators because he's holding a district here that's been slowly becoming more and more DFL. We'll have to see if it holds. It's not a slam dunk, but it's basically he's holding this seat right now. It's Senate District 14, St. Cloud area. Senator Eric Putnam is kind enough to join us today to talk about the redistricting and his time in the Senate. Senator, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Hey, Matt, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you coming on here because you won. Let's talk. When you won by a tiny margin there. How many votes total? Do you remember?
Well, here's the thing, though. So remember, in 2016, this race was decided by, I think, 138 votes.
Yes.
So I won by 315. So I'm calling that a landslide, man.
Okay. You can't do that when I'm drinking water, man. it is a district which has been... It is. It's borderline. It really is one of the real few toss-up districts we have in the state. Talk a little. Let's start first with redistricting. How did 14 change with the new maps?
Well, sure. So it didn't change a great deal. The House districts changed a fair amount, and they actually make a lot more sense now.
Okay.
But the whole larger Senate district didn't change a ton. We did lose a big chunk of one of the townships that traditionally voted probably 70-30 Republican, and we gained a big chunk of St. Joe, which is probably more like 60-40, 45-55 Republican. But so it's a step in the right direction, but it's not a huge one.
It's not a district we can sleep on by any means.
Right. No, it's still going to be tough. It did get a little bit better for me personally. I mean, St. Joe is a great town. I spent a lot of time there. Yeah. I teach at St. Ben's. So I've got a lot of students who are nearby and who are there and some faculty friends. And also my wife was the principal out there, and she's a saint. And incredibly well loved. So she's a saint for lots of different reasons.
Oh,
but she's well respected in that area. So for me personally, things got a little bit better, but we still got a lot of work to make sure that the community understands that our values are their values, because they are.
My daughter's looking at St. Ben's, by the way.
Give me a call.
I will. We've gone up there. We've already toured up there. It's a great college and it's a great area. And it's an area. I mean, one of the things when you step back and look at the redistricting, I mean, a lot obviously is made of the Minneapolis-St. Paul metro area. We're not Illinois yet, though, where the Chicago area controls the rest of the state. We still have a state which, even though we've got that large DFL complex in the Twin Cities. It's these outerlying areas, the Duluth, Rochester, St. Cloud, Moorhead. They are picking up more population, and they should. They're cute. They're nice towns. And as with that comes, as it becomes a little more urbanized, it's becoming more DFL. It is changing because the growth of the entire state is actually at a pretty good level.
Yeah, I think that's totally true. And from my perspective, I don't want us to become more like Illinois. I want us to, as I suggested earlier, I want us as candidates, as DFLers, I'm hoping that we can not convince, but help our neighbors realize that our values are their values. There's been a drift away, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And we have an opportunity to kind of just reinforce that we've always been fighting for you. And we're still doing that. And I think that you're right, too. It's these small cities that I think are going to be the linchpin in this election in the state. A couple of years ago, it was the suburbs. Mm-hmm. This year, it's going to be Rochester and St. Cloud. Mankato, places like that, where I think we have a real chance to make some progress.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, right now, we did the maps when they came on out, we looked at the Twin Cities Metro. There's 29 relatively safe DFL seats. Two other ones in the Metro, which are a little tighter. This is going to come down to St. Cloud and Mankato and Rochester and these other areas. So these seats are important to hold, but you just can't, and let's be honest, people, you cannot just put a one size fits all because the issues in these districts are very unique. You and I were talking. It is amazing to me. We need to, if I can make a suggestion to the DFL, we should get full in right now on water quality, upgrading all the facilities across the state, including in your district, because there are some real water quality issues that are starting to pop up that these facilities are not able to handle.
Absolutely. It's huge. I mean, it's part of the other point that you were making about the populations increasing and the relationships between these small cities and the small towns that are around them. But I have to back up a little bit and go back to paraphrase what you just said, which what I heard which was that St. Cloud was the most important Senate district for the state this year. I thought that's pretty much what I heard you say. That
Matt
no
McNeil says,
without me getting reelected,
goes Senate District 14, goes the state. You heard it right here. I'm on board with you on that one. when you look at this, and you know, like you said, let's touch more on that. It is a double-edged sword. Growth in population is great, but then all of a sudden, you know, the roads that were designed for a certain population standard are just not adequate. Broadband, dear Lord, I still can't believe we've been talking broadband for 12 years in this state. I still can't believe the Republicans have prevented a better expansion of this. Biden is trying to do this. We got this great infrastructure bill. But that's a beginning point. We need to get into these communities. Waterworks, energy, roads, all this stuff needs upgrading because these communities are growing.
Yeah, and we've been neglecting them for so long. I mean, that's the other part of the argument that I think people need to understand a little bit better is that maybe you look at our schools and you look at our infrastructure. Part of the problem is that we've been neglecting them for 20 years, by and large. And so now we have all these changes that are going on outstate, and we have to do catch up and improve at the same time. And that's a real challenge. Mm-hmm. And especially when it comes to broadband. You know, I have folks in San Augusta that I've talked to before. When the pandemic first happened, they had to choose if they were going to Zoom in for work or if their kid was going to be able to do school. Mm-hmm. And that's not a choice that anyone should have to make in a state like Minnesota in a year like 2020.
It isn't, and it just highlights the problem. I mean, I think of anything this last 2 years, as we've gone through this pandemic, we've realized you have to have this basic infrastructure border to border from Crane Lake all the way down to Albert Lee. And if you don't have it, your citizens are only suffering because, as you said, it's more than just, you know, the convenience of a video check-in with a doctor. It's the fact that if we have a pandemic or if a child is sick, they can still do schoolwork. But only if they have the right access. I really wish, and this is me saying this, I really wish that the companies and the state would look at how the internet is given to the suburbs of the Twin Cities and apply that standard everywhere, because reality is if that standard was everywhere, we would have a gem on the world in regards to economic development, as quality of life. I mean, everything across the board would be 1,000 times better because you would have the ability to do work, school, healthcare, via Zoom call and via internet. And I think that's the key.
Well, yeah, you know, in the world that we're in, internet, broadband, that's a basic utility. You know, I mean, I think we'd all be pretty upset if there was a region of the state that didn't have electricity or water. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the model that I think we need to adopt when we think about broadband. It's really that essential at this point, to treat it as a basic utility.
Yes.
And to really invest in it as an infrastructure thing.
Let's talk a little bit about your committees, your aging and long-term care policy. I'm going to talk to you about that in a second here. Higher education and finance policy, jobs and economic growth finance and policy as well. Let's go to aging and long-term care. I mean, we have had a lot of holes in the system exposed in the last 2 years here. It's not a political problem. I think it's a bad strategy as a business model that has gone out there, that there are these holes that are created where we don't have the care we need for the elderly as we need it, especially in rural Minnesota, where you have a aging population and a very aging population in certain parts of the state. Talk about some of the things that you've been working on with that committee.
Well, sure. You know, this is just me and you talking, right? So I can be totally candid.
Sure. No problem.
I've been a little bit disappointed by the lack of work we've done in that committee.
Okay.
Because I think there is such a huge problem and we have such compelling needs. But one thing that I am pretty happy about is the governor's plan for age-friendly cities. It's way overdue. I think that COVID taught us that you can't really store people and think that they're going to be okay.
Yes.
And social isolation was already a problem with seniors, and it just got horribly exacerbated over COVID. And we can't allow that mistake to continue. So the governor's got a plan to try and think about urban planning, transportation, all of those things to make cities age friendly so that seniors can participate in public life, stay home longer, you know, and participate more in public life, feel more integrated, and to fight back against the social isolation that a lot of people feel. It's tough in general, and it's been tough on everybody for 2 years, a million times tougher on a lot of our seniors. So finding ways to integrate them back into the community life. There's a great thing we're doing actually in Waite Park. We're working on building a new Boys and Girls Club with a cop house and a senior center all in the same place.
Nice.
So that we can have, isn't that a brilliant idea?
Yeah, that's a really good idea.
Yeah, so you can have intergenerational mentoring, you know, and you can have the young kids at the Boys and Girls Club teach the seniors about phishing emails, you know, and me. They can teach all of us about those things.
Let's be honest about it. I got kids. I know what you're talking about.
But, I mean, that's the sort of thing we need to do. We need to build greater connections between people, build social infrastructure while we build real infrastructure, too, so that people can help each other out a little bit more.
You and I talked before, and then we talked about the mobility thing. We have in Metro Mobility in the Twin Cities. I mean, that is a program that needs to be, you know, put across the state, because I think it is unfortunate, as you said, that the isolationism is a really nasty thing. And if you're stuck out, especially in maybe off a county road on a rural place, that, you know, as an elderly person in the house you've always lived in, you can't drive anymore. Having that ability to get the person to the store, to the church, to their social club. I mean, it's one of those things which, you know, I think we can look at this in a different dynamic, in a different prism, to realize that there are just some simple, easy things, which I don't think would be too expensive, that we could introduce that would make senior living in outstate Minnesota a much better a possibility.
Right, with a thriving social life, you live longer, you live healthier, and we get to benefit from your wisdom. That's the flip side of this too that I think we need to acknowledge, is that it's not just better for the seniors, it's better for us too.
Mm-hmm. Joining us right now, Democrat of the day, Senator Eric Putnam, District 14 of St. Cloud area right now. What are you focused on as you look at this upcoming session?
Well, there's a couple of really important things. Given the committees that I'm on, one of the things I'm really focused on is workforce development.
Okay.
And trying to make it so that the jobs we need are compensated in a way that befits how much we need them. You know, showing some actual respect and treating people, particularly in the care industries, as the professionals that they are. So I'd like to find a way to get health care for people who are doing child care. Okay. We have a huge crisis for people who are doing child care right now. You know, and some of it's really easy stuff to fix. You know, I was talking to someone at someone who worked at a place called Love and Learn in Way Park. And, you know, she was saying she got paid, I think, $11 an hour or something like that. And she had to spend $100 every 6 months on CEU, on continuing education units. And, you know, in the public schools, you get those for free when you're doing childcare. So it builds this kind of hierarchical system and makes it so much harder to work in that in-home daycare or in that center. And there aren't enough jobs in the public schools to do this stuff. So we have this like built-in disrespect for people who are doing these jobs. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to find ways to show that respect, to get more people to do it, but also because it's right.
You bring that up, and I think this is so important, because these are the people that we demanded. I mean, we're demanded to you. We need you, the frontline workers, to get back to work, not just the nurses and the doctors and the saints that anyone works in the healthcare industry is, but the childcare workers, grocery store workers, delivery drivers. There are so many people there, and I think this is the great awakening that we're going through right now, is that, wait a second here, these jobs, they're not providing enough for people to be able to live off of them and still do them, and we need to go on out there, look at, like you said, getting that training covered, getting better health care options for daycare providers. That's a basic. You know, I think that there are a lot of little things we can do that can make these lives better. And then, you know, people are then not leaving because the cost of the daycare is taking every dime they have from their savings, so they might as well just stay home. So you got to have some better options on the table here to help these people out and make sure we have a better system in place for everyone.
Oh, exactly. You know, and there's two elements to that, at least. I mean, one is the actual practical financial concern, but the other is the level of stress that we are forcing on them, upon people, mm-hmm. when they are working a difficult and not feeling compensated. But the other thing that you were saying kind of brings up the other thing that I think is really important this session, and that's exactly the question of essential worker, frontline worker pay.
Yeah.
You know, when I think of that, I think, you know, two different things. One is that that nurse who had to get to work, that everyone's willing to write a check to get there, they probably had to be in a bus. And that bus driver had to drive that person there. That person is no less essential than that nurse was. And we can't for a second think that the nurse was somehow in a less hygienic space than that public bus was. Mm-hmm. So that bus driver took as big of a risk to get that nurse to work as did the nurse when they went to work. So there's no reason not to acknowledge the sacrifice of that bus driver too. And the other thing that's just as important to realize is that we wouldn't have the surplus that we have if we didn't have people who went to work. You know, you hear a lot about people clamoring for a return of the surplus to the taxpayers. Well, this is that. This is returning the surplus to people who earned it.
Indeed. Indeed. And I think that's the, you know, as people are talking, well, we're going to give a tax break, okay. You know, there's a lot of programs we could fund right now that would have an immediate impact to make the lives better of a lot of Minnesotans. And giving a millionaire and a billionaire a tax break is not one of them. Let's just be honest about it.
No, absolutely. No, I'm totally with you. It doesn't. And the other thing I think that's a problem there is you don't make long-term commitments with one-time money. So you don't change the tax code today because you got a little extra money. That's like, you know, buying a brand new car and not realizing you're going to have to pick another payment next month.
Yeah, I noticed that. I noticed that little problem in the GOP's math myself. It's like, okay, this is a one-time thing. So what happens when things go wrong? Yes.
It just doesn't make any sense, you know, and it's not fiscally responsible. That's the other thing that I think as Democrats, we need to occupy the space of being fiscally responsible and being reasonable. Because when you boil it down to it, that's what we are. Mm-hmm. It is not responsible to give massive tax cuts and to change the tax code right now because we have money today. I mean, we have to think about tomorrow, too.
Absolutely. And it is so important that we don't just do the knee-jerk things that the Republicans are going to try to do. I've got great faith in the House Democrats, the Senate Democrats as well, as the reality is that the Republicans are going to have to work with you guys. And so I'm hoping they're a little more respectful this time around. Here's the deal. We can solve this problem really simply in November. We just give Eric a little gift as being part of the majority in the Senate as opposed to the minority. And we can do that. But I did say this earlier, as 14 goes, the state goes. That's not actually too far away from actual reality. It really isn't. There are a handful of districts. I've already talked about one or two in Duluth, one or two in Rochester. This is a district we have to have. 14 has to be DFL. And so as you're out there, I say this every time, Senator, you go help your local representative, help your local senator for sure. But get the heck out of town. Come, you know, get down to St. Cloud. You got to get into 14. You have to help Senator Putnam in his district. Volunteer, donate. You have to. You have to get up there because we have to hold 14. Absolutely. So if people want to find out more about how they can help your campaign this summer or anytime, as a matter of fact, over the next few months, what's the website for them to go to?
The easy way to get in touch with us is ericformn.com, and I spell my name funny, so it's ericformn.com. I guess, to be honest, my parents spelled my name funny. I was pretty young when I got it, but it's ericformn.com.
ericformn.com. I'll link to everything on social media a little bit later on. I'm dead serious. What are you going to do to make sure the Senate flips to the DFL? Well, one of the things you can do is get up to 14 and make sure that stays in DFL hands. Senator, anytime you want to come on back, by all means, this show is open for you. Please do come back.
Thanks a lot, Matt. I appreciate it. It was fun to chat.
Nice to chat with you as well.